The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Welcome back to part two of Peter Blexley. It's a Dear Love Joy podcast special. I just said Peter Blexley is on it. Hopefully by this stage you've listened to part one, which is tremendous stuff. Mark had gone to the door. That's where we'd left this cliffhanger. He'd gone to the door. Was he going to return? Yes is the answer to that.
It was hi.
It was someone delivering something from Amazon. Mark, were you nervous going to the door?
I wasn't until I heard you and Peter laughing, and then he had his helmet on, delivery helmet.
Not on. Peter, the delivery man.
The delivery man, and he had one of those scanner things that you... And he was holding it in such a manner, I suddenly went, that's it. Like at the end of Sopranos, where it just cuts.
If you don't know what we're talking about, Peter Blexley had a contract on his head. It's in part one. And, you know, they think it's safe now, but I was just worried that he was around my house whilst he's got a contract on his head. And then there was a knock at the door, and Mark had to go and answer it. Anyway, this is part two. This is amazing stuff. So I hope you thoroughly enjoy part one. This is part two, Peter Blexley.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Love Joy.
Fortunately, they didn't have an American accent and they worked from Boston.
Oh, thank God. Thank God you had to go to the door. We're all still alive. Right. Okay. So you went to Kensington.
Yeah, I went to Kensington. Different types of crime. There was some astonishing wealth there, of course, the likes of which I'd never experienced before. Threw myself into it wholeheartedly. Got a lot of experience, particularly around drugs at the time. You know, it was the 1980s. Ronald Reagan over the pond was banging on about the war on drugs, and so were the government over here, and all of that. And of course, as a young, ambitious detective, I wanted to have the title of Scotland Yard detective. I wanted to get onto one of the Scotland Yard squads.
Yeah.
And at the time, people were sounding me out as to whether I wanted to go on the flying squad. And that had some allure, but I felt that armed robbery had probably had its day, to be perfectly honest with you. And I felt that the area of policing that was going to get the attention and the funding and the resources was drugs, because it was very much, you know, that war on drugs generation. And I was fortunate enough to put some feelers out and get sounded out by what was then called the Central Drug Squad at New Scotland Yard. And after I'd finished my posting at Kensington, I was about 25, and I walked through that revolving door at Scotland Yard for the first time, and I thought, yes, let's have some of this.
How long before you're undercover then?
Yeah, well, I'd actually done an extremely unofficial undercover job when I'd been at Kensington. I'd had an informant who'd told me about a dealer in Fulham who was dealing large-scale quantities of LSD, and he said, but the dealer was gay and would only deal with gay people, and the only way we could, the flat was heavily fortified, so if you started bashing the door down, you'd give them plenty of notice that you were coming and they could, you know, destroy things and flash things and all that sort of stuff. And he said, really, if you're going to get in, the only way to do it is to, you know, betray yourself as a gay man and get in there. So I did that. I went to Marks and Spencer's and got myself a string vest. And I was boxing for the Met at the time, so I believe it or not, I was rather lean and fit.
What did a string vest signify?
It was de rigueur at the time. right? It really was amongst certain sections of the gay community. And of course, I was very familiar with the gay community because in Kensington, we covered Earl's Court.
Right.
So I was mixing and talking to the gay community all the time, you know, and was getting on famously with them. And there were some famous pubs down there, the Colhern and all that sort of stuff. And we were breaking the mould, you know, we'd go for a drink after work and I'd say, let's go to the Colhern, you know? And they'd say, yeah, but it's a gay bar. I said, but it's part of the community and we're policing the community.
Yeah.
You know, and we were made incredibly welcome.
Right.
And we had a great time, you know, so we were just trying to, little did we know it, but we were kind of pushing and breaking barriers a bit, I think, anyway. So, I went out and dressed accordingly and put a phone call into the guy. I'd been given the code, which he used when he sold drugs and all that sort of stuff. I used the code and this, that and the other. And I sort of made my way up the stairs to his flat, identified myself. He let me in. I was suitably dressed. Bless him, I'm going to flatter myself now. He started flirting with me outrageously. And I sort of, you know, told him that I had a boyfriend, et cetera, and that was deeply flattering, but can we just get on with some business, please? And when he pulled out his stash, of course, I arrested him. So, and he fainted, bless him. So that was my first very unofficial sojourn into being an undercover cop. But when I got to Scotland Yard and I saw how they did it, the first undercover operation I was ever a part of, I was on one of the backup teams, and the deal was scheduled to go down in the car park of Regent's Park opposite the zoo. And there was three undercover cops, two men and a woman.
Hold on, because I thought you always did it on your own. You sometimes do it in teams undercover.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, go on.
Yeah, yeah,
sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is the first one that I'm experiencing,
right, okay,
for real.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm hidden on the top deck of a bus that we commandeered,
yeah,
that was parked in the sort of coach park a bit of there. So we're all lying on the floor, radios in our ears, guns at the ready, all that sort of stuff. I didn't have a gun on that day. So we're all waiting and we can hear the commentary coming through our ears. And what happened was the three cops that were working undercover, the two men and the woman, were in a car, in the car park, and they had 70 grand of the commissioner's money in the boot of the car, in a hold-all. Now, what had happened was that these villains thought these undercover cops weren't proper villains and they thought they could rob them. So they actually turned up with no intention of serving them with 4 or 5 kilos of heroin, whatever it was. The villain's sole intention was to rob what they thought were a bunch of lightweight villains of their money. So my mate, who was in the driver's seat acting undercover, wound the window down and got ammonia squirted in his face. And then they bashed the other couple of cops, got the keys, opened the boot, and off they went with 70 grand of the commissioner's money. Right? And they disappeared. Needless to say, a lot of people were extremely worried at this stage. So they disappeared with 70 grand of the commissioner's money. All hell broke loose. Absolutely. We all piled off the bus. Everybody's running in this direction and that direction. I managed to chase one of the bad guys and I'm through the sort of wooded, not wooded area, but it's grass and trees and what have you, past the car park. I'm legging it after him. He suddenly turns around and levels a gun at me, right? But at this point, I was running so fast, I could not stop. So I had absolutely no choice but to just keep carrying on. And I clattered into him, rugby tackled him to the ground. He got nicked. A couple of the others got nicked. But for about 20 minutes, they couldn't find this 70 grand of the commissioner's money. Now, the officer who was in charge of that operation later said that night, he said, "Today I discovered that adrenaline runs down your leg." Right? Because he thought his career was going to be over.
Yeah.
As it happens, a couple of the bad guys had decamped into the zoo and they'd hidden it under a tarpaulin in a skip.
Right.
Because they all thought they'd leg it and get away and then come back and retrieve the 70 grand the following day. Anyway, they didn't. The 70 grand got retrieved. The bad guys got nicked. They got charged with robbery. And I vowed that day that nobody was going to rob me of 70 grand. I could be a more convincing gangster than perhaps my colleagues can be. So the next time we had a briefing, And it was so unscientific in those days. Literally, the governor said, right, we've got an undercover job. Anybody want to have a go? Whoosh! My hand was straight up. And I just discovered that I had a propensity for lying. So I became a professional state-employed liar. And I
it's really the one thing I know about life is lying is really hard, and it and it doesn't make you particularly happy. It takes its toll, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. But in the early days, for that decade or so when I was undercover,
yeah,
you know, for most of that 10 years, I had a blast. I had the most amazing, exciting, unforgettable time just going out there and convincing career criminals. People that had been born into crime, lived their life in crime, were making a good living out of crime. I'm sitting across a table from them in a pub and they are convinced I'm one of theirs.
Yeah.
And actually I'm old Bill.
Yeah.
It was very, very satisfying.
Was it adrenaline buzz constant?
Enormously. Enormously. Learning to control that adrenaline became something I was very good at. You know, I could feel it rising in me as I went out to go and do the job. You know, you've had the briefing, that's all fine. You've ditched your warrant card, you've got your fake ID, you're getting prepared, you're briefing your mate, who might be your driver or your minder or something like that. And then you go out and you can feel it. You can palpably feel the adrenaline start to begin coursing through your veins, and then you have to learn how to control it.
Is it combined with fear?
Yes, there is an element of fear. And I often used to, if I'd been in a hotel bar or a pub or a restaurant or this, that and the other, I would get up from the chair that I'd been sitting in and I'd often look back at it just to make sure my arse hadn't taken chunks out of it, because, you know, it was that terrifying. You know,
so when you finish a case, is it like taking a tight shoe off? You suddenly go, oh, God, thank God for that. I can become Peter again for a while.
That's a great analogy there. The sense of relief, because invariably a lot of the time, you see, I would be almost at the scene of the crime when the hit went down.
Right.
Because obviously I'd have to be there to test or to weigh the drugs. You know, I'd have to see the weapons. I would have to see that lorry load of trainers or scotch or counterfeit currency, or all of that. I'd have to be there, still in my role as a villain, to say, right, okay, yeah, right, everything's in hand, all the goods are here, all the drugs, or the guns, or whatever it is, right, now I'll put a phone call in for my mate to come and deliver the money.
And what sort of phone calls? There's no mobile phones, was there then? Or were they just...
There was towards they were just the latter coming, part. Right, okay. Yeah. So, you know, and sometimes you go and find a phone box, or, you know, do all of that, make your excuses to put that call in to call the money on. So it often meant that I had to leg it from the scene of the crime, because then officers who were hidden in covert vans and cars and disguised as workmen or wherever we might be would suddenly break cover and jump all over the bad guys in order to keep my identity secret. Invariably, I had to escape from the scene of the crime.
Yeah.
Yeah? So I would be legging it over walls and fences and whacking colleagues and this, that and the other to make my escape look genuine.
Right.
You know, and then...
Just like the movies, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, I hate to say it, but it kind of is, isn't it?
It was. And then, you know, at the end of that, when you talk about taking that tight shoe off, you know, when the people are nicked, the goods or the contraband are seized, all the evidence is there, my role is over, I go back, write up my evidence. Of course, my colleagues would invariably have a long night in front of them because they'd have to process the prisoners and all that sort of stuff. But then the boss would allocate somebody and he'd say, right, go and take Blex for a drink, you know, and you'd go off and you'd have a drink. And then hopefully as your colleagues finished, they would come in and join you. And, you know, you got a lot of plaudits. I had a lot of smoke blown up my rear end. You know, I was extremely highly regarded at what I did because, dare I say it, I was pretty good at it.
Yeah.
And it was an amazing time.
And how long would you be on a case?
Oh, sometimes you could have a case done and dusted in a day. You'd get an informant ringing first thing in the morning and say, I've got a geezer's got a parcel for sale. Can you meet him at lunchtime? Yeah. And I'd go, yeah, all right. And you could have that deal done and dusted that night.
Yeah.
Okay. Others would take months.
Right. Okay.
Months and months.
Is there
and
a crossover though between the villains? Right. You suddenly go, oh Christ, I'm involved in this yet. I'm going to meet these guys, and I've already been involved with those guys as well. Or were you becoming a bit of a rep as a villain in London?
That was a question that I was asked once by an extremely senior member of the leadership team at Scotland Yard. And I said, you know what? And this was with regards to drugs. You know, he said, you know, you're so successful as an undercover cop. You're infiltrating so many drugs organisations. You know, isn't there a fear that there's going to be some cross-fertilisation and you'll get recognised? I said, no. I said, and what you need to appreciate, is the scale of what we're up against. Because the drugs industry was just exploding enormously.
Was it coming from America? Was it coming straight from South America? Cocaine are you talking about?
Stuff, yeah, well, right? Cocaine, yeah. Obviously, Bolivia, Peru, Venezuela, Colombia, you know.
Was it coming straight in here?
Oh, there were various shipping routes, and they were pretty smart and clever, as they still are today, as to how they would transport it. A lot of the time, we felt it was being transited through Rotterdam and Amsterdam. Other times, it would come up through Spain. That was an ever more prevalent route.
Was it all connected to, who's your man from Narcos? Escobar.
Yeah, Pablo Escobar.
Was it all connected down that route?
Well, those links were unavoidable, and we took out a mafia lot, and they actually it was Bolivian cocaine. They'd got a quite a successful smuggling route established from Bolivia, and they then transported it to Argentina, and they welded it into the arms of JCB type diggers, you know, so these massive digger arms are getting transported in containers, and actually they've got hundreds of kilos of cocaine welded into them. And such were the sort of ingenious methods that people used then, and of course still do today. But of course, you know, the drugs, my views on drugs and the whole drug industry and law enforcement and all of that have changed entirely. And I now, sadly, look back on the majority of my career and think, you know what, are there less guns and drugs on the streets now as a result of what I did? Well, and the answer is a resounding no.
Yeah, but the question I want to ask you is, being at the coalface of it all, should they have been illegal in the first place? It's a real tough thing for politicians to think this through, because whilst we're trying to, say, protect our children from evil drugs, meanwhile in South America, people are being slaughtered left, right and centre because there's all the crime over here and everything else, so we can get the cocaine back to put in the people in the nightclubs, whatever they are. You know, it's kind of a bit of a weird equation for them, isn't it, really?
Well, consequently, I look back on my career and think the overwhelming majority of it was a complete and utter waste of time.
No, so, really?
Yeah, of course I do. Yeah, the time is ripe now for drug law reform. We absolutely need drug law reform. And come the revolution, when I'm in charge of this country,
vote Peter, right? Yeah.
Okay. We will legalise and regulate every drug. Legalise, regulate, and we could pop out now, walk up to the chemist or the drugstore, what would be more imaginatively named than that, and we could buy it.
Regulate meaning?
Regulate, so same as alcohol, tobacco, those kind of
An
things.
An age limit. As in, you have to be a certain age to buy
much. We'd have to be very liberal with that. What you need to do, because it's ludicrous, okay? The drugs industry is confidently estimated to be worth about $500 billion a year.
Yeah.
Okay? And we leave that massive global industry in the hands of organised crime. It's frankly ludicrous. Would we let organised crime run our railways? Would we let them run our NHS? No, of course we wouldn't. But we let them run the drugs industry. It's nonsense. The time now is right, and there is a growing movement towards this, towards drug law reform, so that we legalise and we regulate. It will work on so many levels. I'm not talking to the converted here, am I?
No, I am. I've always been thinking about it for a long time now, and it's that hard thing, isn't it? Of I'm a bit worried about governments deciding to protect us, and how they can protect us from some drugs and not the others. You know, we're allowed to smoke and drink, but we're not allowed to do this and that. Yeah. I don't actually take drugs, but I've always fascinated by watching people take drugs and thinking, but where that's come from has been just hell for the people involved in it, and yet you're standing there in the night.
We could transform the lives of the coca leaf farmers in South America. We could, with a global movement, with strong governmental agreements, we could start to make the world a much, much better place.
Yeah, we've also, they've lost control already because there's all those new drugs, which, what are they called? The ones you can actually buy in the shops, which, what are they called? Pardon? Well, no, not the laughing gas.
The synthetic highs, all those
sort of things. Yeah. They've come along now.
Yeah, but of course they've grown because there's been difficulty in getting hold of the real stuff, the proper stuff.
Yeah.
Right? When you find that cocaine, ecstasy, heroin is legally available and you can go and purchase it at will, the requirement for these particularly toxic drugs that people make up from the contents of the cupboard under their sink, essentially, the requirement for those toxic drugs will disappear, in my opinion. When people can go and buy what is a properly manufactured, regulated drug, there will be no need to get your chemistry kit out and make something so poisonously toxic as they do.
And it also won't all be cut up with rat poison or whatever else which we're sticking in
people. And legalisation and regulation will do away with that. But you know what you have to do? You have to beat the villains on three factors. Because let's face it, organised crime is not going to give up its major revenue stream without a fight. So you are, at the end of the day, going to have conversations, particularly in source countries like Mexico and Colombia. You're going to have conversations with some people that many would regard as unsavoury. But that's happened in the past. Northern Ireland, anybody? We've got peace over there, generally speaking. Sometimes peace requires brave politicians to have brave conversations with people they wouldn't want to be in the same room as, but you have to do it. If we can beat organised crime on price, purity and availability, they have nowhere to go. They can't have a black market, they can't wrestle the industry back, and we will win, and the benefits will be enormous.
Didn't you work in Northern Ireland as well?
No, although, how do we put this? I had some dealings with people whose activities were funded by terrorism.
Right, okay. When you're, like, you've mentioned two things now that you've been involved in, Brixton and the drugs, which you've gone a bit of a waste of time, really. As in, not Brixton wasn't a waste of time, but you know, you could see the bad side of the police, and now you're saying the drugs seem to be a waste of time. You look back at your career, are you not satisfied then with what's happened?
You know, I don't live my life looking back over my shoulder. I live it looking forward, you know, and that's just how it was. You know, that's just how it was. In the 1980s, everybody was telling us on the Central Drug Squad at Scotland Yard, we were doing a vitally important job in this war, you know, and suddenly I was a young man. I was in my mid-20s, you know, impressionable, not well-educated. And I'm thinking, yeah, okay, this is my war. I'm going to fight it. I had more time and energy than you know to spare, and so I channeled my energies into that.
Would those villains be have moved into another? If the drugs were legal, they'd moved into something else anyway.
But they're already morphing into cybercrime and sadly other things like human trafficking.
Human trafficking's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and not a subject I'm particularly well versed upon, to be honest with you. Apart from reading the horrors and hearing the horrors of it as we do through our news outlets.
What creates these... Go on, sorry, I was interrupting.
Yeah, no.
What creates villains?
There's that usual debate. Is it nature? Is it nurture? Poverty is absolutely unavoidable in terms of so much crime. You know, poverty, a lack of opportunity, the lack of a decent education. But, you know, if you're born into a family that have no disregard for working hard, paying their taxes and being a contributing member to society, then can you really blame that young person if they pursue the same route?
All right, the one question I have to ask you, which everyone thinks about, the blurred lines. You become friends with these people. Is there ever a time where you think, oh God, I don't really want to put you away because you're actually a really nice guy and you've had a bad lot in life and blah, 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 blah. Did that ever happen to you?
I was in a hotel bar laughing my head off with some of the most vibrant, witty, entertaining company I'd ever spent any time with. We shook hands, we patted each other's on the shoulder, and we vowed to meet the following week. And we were celebrating a deal well done. I walked out of that hotel bar and I knew that they faced a long, long time in prison. You know, was it unfortunate? I tell you, the unfortunate thing was they were such talented people that if they'd applied their energies elsewhere, I think they could possibly made a success of whatever they did. But they'd chosen to fund their lifestyles through breaking the law.
Seeing what you've seen, why don't you get involved in politics?
No, too many skeletons. You know, too many skeletons. And,
I think that's not, I don't think that's a problem anymore.
No, maybe.
Look what's happening in America. You do whatever you want.
Maybe not.
But I'm only saying this because you've seen the reason why these people turn out the way they have, and so yeah. And you've seen what happens on street level, basically. So there's problems which need to be addressed.
There's a mainstream party that will always have my vote, but there's not a mainstream party that I would align myself to.
Okay. What about women? That's always the thing which comes up with undercover cops. There was compensation payments not so long ago for a woman who had a child and with an undercover cop. Surely you must, as part of your cover, have relationships with women.
I did. Now, I did one evening. I had a one-night stand with a woman who was facilitating a considerably sized drug deal. She was actually representing an organisation that was using the diplomatic bag, so the diplomatic transport system through which to facilitate drug movements. So, you know, the diplomatic bags can't be touched or examined by anybody, customs or this, that and the other.
Okay.
And they were very much abusing that to smuggle substantial quantities of cocaine into the UK. And if I hadn't had that relationship with that woman, albeit a one-night sort of thing, she thought it was going to be a longer thing, that smuggling route might still be operating today. Do the ends justify the means? I know it's a very thorny subject, and I'm not afraid to tackle it head on. That was an operational necessity. But where my justification comes is, you can check the names, you can check the convictions, and what that operation ended in. Convictions of people for serious criminality.
Yeah.
Right. If we're talking about the whole spy cops inquiry that's going on at the moment and all the revelations that have come out recently about undercover cops, not my colleagues, but from Special Branch and other units like the National Public Order Intelligence Unit and all these people who didn't deal with serious and organised crime, they were dealing with the policing of politics, which is a completely different thing to what I did. I never met any of them. I never even knew that their work existed. We did crime. They were doing politics. And I'll tell you where the big difference is between what I did on that one night and what they systematically did over months or years. They deliberately targeted vulnerable women on the periphery of political organisations. You know, and we're not talking Bader Meinhof here or anything like that. You know what I mean? We're talking some pretty fluffy tree-hugging organisations as far as I'm concerned. And there's nothing wrong with tree-hugging. I'm just saying, for the purposes of drawing a clear comparison here. And these undercover cops were going out, fathering children, having premeditated, long-term, established relationships, duplicitous relationships with these women. That, I would argue, all day long, was a very, very different thing to my brief sojourn, which led to criminal convictions for serious crime. Mm. So what were this lot doing? Where were their management? Where was their supervision? Where are their convictions? Because where's the justification? I can't find any.
Okay. Is there still a demand for undercover cops?
Oh, yes. As long as lying exists in the human nature, then there is, and criminality, of course, then there is always, there will always be opportunities for undercover cops to infiltrate.
Is it hard now, though? Because years ago, you could just buy a string vest and get away with it. Now, now you've got to start doing. You need a Twitter account. You need a social media profile. You need credit cards, mobile phones, don't you? Otherwise, people are going to find you out.
How do they do that? I mean, and they must be doing it. They absolutely must be doing it. I'm sure there is probably somebody working away in an office now creating social media profiles that will be used in 5, 10, 20 years' time.
Yeah.
You know, and so I've really scratched my head and would shake their hand in admiration for anybody who's still doing it today. And they are. They're out there doing it.
And is it hard to recruit? Say you're, I mean, they must be recruiting to try and get into sort of Islamist, sort of fundamental Islamist organizations and stuff like that. That must be hard to recruit, isn't it, to do that sort of stuff?
I would imagine so.
Or is it easy to find young men who want to do this stuff?
Well, we hope, don't we, that our police service is going to become more representative of the society it polices, so that there's going to be more people from black and Asian and minority ethnic backgrounds than ever before. And consequently, I'm sure some of those will be getting sounded out on the day they walk into their training establishment and saying, boom, do you fancy a bit of this? You any good at this? You know, language skills are far more necessary these days and all of that. So let's hope they're modernising. Let's hope undercover policing is modernising, because there will always be an opportunity for undercover cops to be deployed.
I just said something really sexist, by the way. I said young men, because in my mind, it feels like a man's job. It's obviously they're recruiting women as well. What are the skills you actually really need to be an undercover cop? Because it's kind of a tough job, that.
I worked with some amazing undercover female officers. I really did. I worked with some terrific operators. Really, really good. And I thought I could lie. Lie me. They were really, really wonderful. And they were every inch as capable and courageous and committed as any male undercover cop I ever worked with.
But what skills do you need apart from the ability to lie?
That's it. You've got to be able to lie and sphincter
and
control.
Hold your bottle.
Yeah.
Do you have memories which aren't yours? As in, say your profile was David Smith. Have you got a memory from David Smith or categorised? Were you always able to stay as Peter Blexley, or did you actually move into these other characters for a while?
I mean, I think the best lie is one that's always closest to the truth. So, you know, I had colleagues, for example, who were public school educated, one of whom was an incredibly successful art expert. That was his passion in life. And of course, he brought that to the undercover world.
Right.
And he was incredibly successful in recovering stolen works of art from around the world. And now I could never profess to be some public school educated art expert.
Yeah.
But I was really good as his driver or minder. So sometimes, and he loved working with me. So okay. I go, Blex, are you busy on a job? But please say you're not. And I'd say, yeah, all right, yeah. And it'd be great, come and mind me. He said, I've got a right load of poshies, you know, to deal with. But he said, you know, and you'll have a good time with them. And then, of course, I would don my very somber, menacing driver minder kind of profile. And, you know, and search people and all that kind of stuff. And just be frankly unpleasant, brutal and menacing. But it was all, again, fairly close to that sort of South London, you know, white boy, businessman, wrong'un, that kind of stuff. Stick to what you know.
Okay. I'm conscious, I'm mindful that we've gone on for quite a long time, but I really want to just talk about your book. And I think it's good we've gone on for a long time, because we've covered a lot of good ground here. You've got the book out, On the Run. And again, it's, you can't give it up, can you? You're still chasing criminals now, even though you've retired. Tell us about the book.
That's because I'm a one-trick pony. That's all I've got.
It's not bad, though.
Yeah,
is it true you've got a 100% record of catching murderers?
In solving murders, yeah, because I didn't do that many murders, right? And okay. I did them early in my detective career, right. But I never worked on an unsolved one. And then when I left the cops, you know, and, you know, The Gangbuster had been written and I'd done some TV consultancy and all that kind of stuff. You know, I just want to, I became fascinated in how people could commit murder in the 21st century and get away with it. Because I'm thinking mobile phones, CCTV, forensic science, it must be almost impossible.
Yeah.
You know, unless you've got a rod of ice. right?
Okay. I've read that, Peter, on the internet.
How can people commit murder and get away with it? And I became truly fascinated by it. So I went out and I researched a number of 21st century unsolved murders. And then I revisited them, you know, and I had an amazing time. I found that I sometimes got further with a business card than I ever did with a warrant card.
Right.
And I've researched them and revisited them. And yeah, On the Run is the result of that. Some of these cases remain stubbornly unsolved, but in recent weeks and months, I've got names. People have contacted me. I'm very fortunate in so much as that when I get out there and meet people, they tend to trust me and they want to talk to me. And I've got names and I will be knocking on doors. And I will be, just like I did with one of the cases in the book, where I confronted a man in a pub car park and I said, "You shot him." I'll be doing that again to other people because I'm determined to try and move these cases on if I possibly can.
And what was the reaction like from the guy when you said that to him?
He laughed. And I took that as an admission of guilt. But anyway, something very interesting happened to him not long after.
Okay, which is in the book. What do the police think of you now?
Unfortunately, they tend to have a bit of a, what I would say, a narrow-minded attitude towards me. They don't cooperate with me. The overwhelming majority of police forces don't cooperate with me. I think they wish I would crawl back under the stone from whence I came and stop trying to highlight some of their greatest or most least successful investigations, shall we say. But I think they're wrong. And I'm hoping that the tide is going to turn. The week after next, I've been invited to speak at a National Police Chiefs Council conference on neighbourhood policing, funnily enough. So I'm going to go and speak there, you know, as a bit of an after-dinner thing. And I'm going to tell them that I think they need to reassess. Of course, the Leveson inquiry kind of changed the landscape in how the police and the media kind of coexist these days, or if they actually do. But Leveson didn't say you can't talk to one another. I think what it said in very broad strokes is you've got to do it openly and properly and transparently.
Yeah.
And not have backdoor deals and all that sort of stuff. And I've never wanted anything like that. So I'm hoping that, you know, if I'm suddenly getting invited to a National Police Chief's dinner to speak, that perhaps I might be coming in from out of the cold. I don't know. But, you know, I'm writing another book on an unsolved murder now, where they steadfastly refuse to speak to me. But as I shall say at this dinner, you know, I may be coming to your town, village or city to investigate one of your unsolved murders. And I may just have a TV production company in tow. We may make a documentary as well as write a book. So there's going to be an awful lot of publicity about cases. Do you want to be a part of it or don't you? The choice is yours.
Yeah. Talked about neighbourhood policing there. People often, a lot of people are throwing the stuff around being about the police being underfunded at the moment, especially in the communities. What's your thoughts on that?
Cuts to police budgets in recent years have been savage, and there is a price to pay. Police numbers have been cut dramatically, and we don't most definitely have the bobbies on the beat that we once did. In fact, I somewhat fear that the bobby on the beat may be a thing of the past. In any event, neighbourhood policing is vitally important. I think knowing a policeman is absolutely vital to somebody who might know something and might just want to talk. If they can put a face to that name and they've got a number, someone they can reach out to, even if it's that they've got a local police station they can go and knock on the door of and say hello to, which increasingly they haven't, because police stations are getting closed left, right and centre and converted into flats and restaurants and all of that. I know money is the driver. I know it's the budget cuts which are driving all of this. But the cuts to neighbourhood policing, the lack of police premises where people can identify and walk into is damaging. And I'm sure that if a senior cop could be brutally honest, they would say, we don't want to close them. We don't want to reduce the neighbourhood cops. We'd like to keep them at previous, what were unprecedented levels, but we can't.
Well, what's the morale like in the police at the moment? I asked that because I had something like, I can't even remember the number now, six scooters. I ride Vespas and I've given up now because there were six stolen in 18 months. Was it that, Mark? It was something stupid like that. Literally three locks over a fence. You've seen my front gun. It's really heavy. They got it over that fence the last time. But two times ago, I got it stolen in Warwick Avenue by Warwick Avenue Tube Station. The police actually saw the guys, so they just dumped it. By the time I got there, the police officer looked so miserable. I actually felt more sorry for him than I did for me, or the fact that these guys feel they should be stealing the scooters, because he just went, "There's nothing we can do about it. We're not allowed to chase. We're not allowed to." And he just looked like, he looked sad about the situation. Like there's nothing he can do about it. It is a tough situation with the scooters.
He probably was, and they're probably the words that every police officer dreads saying, isn't it? There's nothing we can do about it. You want to be able to do something. You've joined public service to be able to do something about it. And when you can't, I would find that massively frustrating. The landscape, the job, the demands have all changed dramatically since my day. And they have my absolute sympathy. I hear a lot of anecdotal evidence about morale being absolutely rock bottom. But fortunately, many thousands of men and women continue to remain dedicated to the job, and we owe them a great thank you.
I suppose the theory is if you keep cutting budgets, then you're sending the message that you're not valuable to society. And everyone keeps on saying police is changing. It's all more about cyber and all that sort of stuff. But I think the reality is, what I'm hearing is that being actually in the neighbourhood, in the community, is very good for both sides.
It's absolutely vital, not only in terms of local crime, in quelling that antisocial behaviour, because you know what street corner they're going to be kicking the tin can around, and worse, possibly. You know all of that. You've got the eyes and ears of the public on the ground. It's great for helping to stem crime trends. If there's a spate of burglaries and you've got that wonderful curtain twitching British public on your side, that's all vitally, vitally important. But it can also have an impact on the most serious of criminality, because if there is a young, disenfranchised, disillusioned person that is being drawn towards radicalism, it's probably going to be somebody in the community that will identify that first. And if they have a link, that friendly cop, that trusted cop that they can speak to, that's the person where the informational flow will begin with.
Yeah. Would you recommend people, young guys and girls at the moment, to men and women, to go into the force?
In the blink of an eye.
Really?
It is an astonishing job like no other. It gives you an opportunity to contribute and help shape the society in which we live. There really is nothing else like it. You won't get rich and you won't be popular. But if you can live with that and you want to really, really make a difference every single day of the week, then please join.
Cool, they should put you on the advert, shouldn't they? That's a really good endorsement there. Right, we ask all our guests who come on. Thanks, by the way, for I've taken up loads of your time. I could talk all day with you. You've got such brilliant stories. But we ask all the people who come on this podcast the same questions, so I'm going to ask them to you. What one piece of advice would you give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Be committed, whatever you do. It's the C word, and I live my life by the C word. You have to be committed. Don't do anything half-hearted. Just don't do it. Either be entirely committed to whatever it may be in your life, whether it's your career, it's your hobby, whatever you do, please be committed, because you will reap so, so many benefits out of it.
And you've obviously got to be committed in yours, because if you don't and you go in half-hearted, you could end up dying, basically. How many times you had guns pulled on you, or how many times you felt your life was threatened?
I've stared down the barrel of a gun on three occasions.
Oh, God, I can't. It's just making me feel weird thinking about it.
You know, and I got stabbed in the neck once, that fading scar, and you can still just about see it there. I got kidnapped. I got held hostage once, which was a particularly nerve-wracking experience, and I was told the only way I would get out of those premises was, the guy said, is with six of these in your back. And he pointed to swords and knives and all of that that were on the wall.
Did he know you were a copper then? Or,
no.
All right, okay. No, you've been kidnapped there.
No,
all right.
No. Fortunately, my colleagues were able to rescue me on that occasion. I've never been so happy to see a cop's face in my life. So I've had a few scrapes, but, you know, here to tell the tale, which is I'm very pleased about.
Okay. What mistake do people make? Maybe doing your job or just maybe in life?
What mistake do people make? In undercover policing, don't go on too long. Know when you've lost your edge, okay? And don't be afraid to stick your hand up and say, Governor, do you know what? This job's not for me now, okay? Right. There's no shame in it. You've given more to society than they could possibly have expected from you. So if you've worked undercover, you feel that edge is just going, bail out. Just bail out. You owe nobody anything.
And if you're a murderer, the mistake you make is not using ice rods because they're really good. I've read it. any life hacks? They maybe traveled car. You must have some life hacks because you've had to. Did you have to have like multiple sets of credit cards and stuff like that all the time?
Yes, I did. I did indeed.
What life hack have you got?
What life hack have I got? Well, you know, it's. Now, dare I say it, dental work is expensive.
Yes.
Okay, even if you're an NHS, an NHS client, patient, dental work is expensive. And in the main, it's uncomfortable, it's unpleasant, it can be extremely painful, right? These lessons I have learned. So if there is any hack that I can give to people out there, you will notice carry a flosser daily, right? I have the little Twinkie brushes at home. With which I do the gaps between my teeth religiously, right? I'm desperately trying to hang on to what I've got.
So your life hack is oral hygiene.
Correct.
Good oral hygiene. Fantastic. That's really good. Were you ever out and did you always take the? Were you always called Peter something, or did you take other?
No, I had other Christian names.
So was there a stage where someone would be going? Dave, and you're thinking, that's not me, I'm Peter. Oh, damn, that's me. Yeah.
That's why I was very careful with the names I chose. I lived with a mate of mine for a while, a very good mate, my sadly departed best mate.
Yeah.
And we shared a flat and then we shared a house together and all of that. And whenever we were out, I always reacted to his name.
Right.
Right, because we were that close. Right. Somebody calls his name, I look over.
Right.
Who wants my mate, right? Yeah. So I used his name quite a bit.
Right, okay. Yeah,
because I knew I would react to the calling of his name. We also had a garage maintenance man at the yard who looked after all the vehicles, right? And he was absolutely wonderful fella. And so I adopted his name sometimes.
Right.
Because likewise, any name that you react to, then use it.
And
be very, very careful.
And how many times did you slip up with not just names with anything and go, oh shit, I've given the game away here. Please
don't confuse him with me, somebody else.
Pro. I love it. Pro. A new question we just added recently. Any books you recommend?
Yeah, The Gangbuster and On the Run by Peter Blexley.
All right, you can have that. We often ask people what it's like to be famous. You must have get recognition now, do you, in the road and stuff, in the street?
I do a bit, but I don't really think I classify as famous. But I do get recognised a bit.
Okay. People just come up and rabbit onto you a lot about Hunted.
And it's lovely. Yeah. They love the show. Yeah. They want to talk about it and all of that. And I'm always very... I love that. That's nice.
Okay. What's the meaning of life?
You can only really achieve true happiness, I believe, in life when you learn to love others more than you love yourself.
Ooh.
For a long time in my earlier years, I was a self-absorbed, self-opinionated, mature little prick who was so in love with himself, he had no room in his heart for anybody else. As I grew up and I realized that life was enhanced beyond my wildest dreams by loving others more than I love myself, I discovered the meaning of life and the key to true happiness.
That's the drive, though, isn't it? When you were a young man and you wanted to, you decided to become a cop and an undercover cop and stuff. Your drive is because you got a kind of you know, you do love yourself and you think, I can do this and I'm invincible. You sort of need those skills, don't you? Do you think, to begin with?
I still think I would have been just as good an undercover cop if I could have loved others more than I loved myself.
Okay. A question I've not asked anyone else before, but I'll ask you: will you go to heaven, Peter?
I'm an atheist.
Oh, damn! Have you had a good life?
Yeah, and more to come, hopefully.
More to come. Right. Okay. Your books are The Gangbuster and On the Run. So well worth a read of those. But if people want to follow you, where can they follow you? You're on Twitter.
At Peter Blexley. My name is spelled a bit unusually.
Yeah.
My surname is B-L-E-K-S-L-E-Y. So I'm at Peter Blexley.
And are you on Instagram or anything else, or is it just
Twitter? I'm on Facebook, but Facebook and Twitter.
Right,
that's okay. About as far as my limited social media skills go.
Peter, thank you so much for coming in today. It's been an absolute pleasure. And hopefully you'll come back with your next books out so we can do more stories.
Thank you very much indeed.
Cheers. So that's Peter Blexley. I tell you what, we do a lot on this podcast, advice. He's definitely lived his life to the full. And when he's lying on his deathbed, we always talk about this. And when you look back and see what you did with your life, he's not going to go, well, I wasted it, is he? He's definitely lived it to the full. He's seen so many things and got so many stories. We really need to get him back when he gets his new book out.
Yes, please. Yes, yes.
And get some more stories out of it. So many things he talks about which were interesting.
The Brixton riots really stuck out for me. I've actually heard a family friend talk about them as well. And again, just sort of him talking about them, what a time that just must have been. He was saying that you could feel the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
The way he talks about it is so interesting. And then the way he talks about drugs as well.
Yes.
Spending his life trying to stop drug dealers, and now he's going to legalize it. It's just, it's fantastic, you know. Yeah. He's got knowledge on the stuff. Yes. So, you know.
Vote Peter.
Yeah.
Well actually, would you be his deputy or would he be your deputy?
I think we go up against each other.
Would you be the Chancellor?
Death match at the end. I'd let him. I would let him be the boss. And
so he'd live at number 10
until I'd made my ice rod.
he'd be
good. I'd take over with my ice rod.
He'd be good. He'd be good to have as a neighbour if you're at 11 Downing Street.
I can't wait till we start filming these, because his face when I started talking about my ice rod was just.
he looked at you in pity.
I was expecting him to indulge me. Yeah, Tim, that's right. And he just looked like...
You idiot. You idiot, Lovejoy.
I spent far too much time on the internet. That was brilliant. I really enjoyed his company. It was absolutely. There's so much to talk about there. I hope you enjoyed it. I'd love you to comment on what you think about Peter and that podcast. You can contact us at Tim Lovejoy is my Twitter address. DearLovejoyPodcast@gmail.com is our email. You can subscribe to us, rate us 5 stars. We've got loads more great interviews coming up over the next couple of weeks. We've got some real crackers coming up for you. But for the time being, we'll see you next time, and peace and love, Joy.
Peace and ice rod. Bye.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.